Wonderful. Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. If we're lucky, it will rain and you will slalom home. But I don't know if you know this, Naomi, but the ground here has this layer of caliche, which is impermeable. So when we get a heavy rainstorm, it just floods. And literally, you can slalom on your way home in the car. Your tires don't bite. It's awful. Anyway, virtual audience, you don't care. So thank you very much for joining us also. I'm really pleased to be talking to Naomi about Japantown number 2, the follow-up to Clark and Division, which garnered practically every mystery award that was going. Now, how do you feel about having this burst of flame? Fame, because you have had it before, but you know, you've been writing a long time.
Yes, my first mystery came out in 2004. It's been interesting. So I've been on tour. I went to New York, D.C., and Chicago. And I believe a couple bookstores said Clark and Division was my debut. And then I was like, I think actually it's like number 11 or 12. But it's still kind of interesting. And I do feel in a way that it has been a rebirth of my writing career. I just entered my 60s and I thought, you know, okay, this is my career trajectory is going to go down. And, you know, I was even telling my husband, I think I have to retire now. And he's going, what? No. And so, yeah, the reception to Clark and Division has been a surprise, a nice surprise. And who thought during the pandemic too?
Well, there were lots of reasons I can think of why it did so well, but I think, oh, good. Hi, sweetheart. This is our little Havanese puppy here. She was so good. Her hairdo is beyond fabulous. Yeah. I'm trying to emulate it, but it doesn't work quite as well. I need a rubber band. I wrote to you all the other, or maybe I didn't. I did in the book news and all, about when I'm looking for our books of the month. I try to find new authors and new voices for you and kind of surprises, but it's also important to read authors that you think you know or that you do know and discover that they too can surprise you. Now, I've read your Masari books and, you know, other work, and then here came Clark and Division, and, you know, I could have just said, oh, look, it's another, you know, but that's not how we operate here. You know, we do try to read all the books, and especially for authors that are coming to see us. I don't know if you have seen the statistics, Naomi, but for the last 4 weeks, each week there have been 280-plus new hardcover fiction releases every single week. And so we have to start thinking about triage, you know, what can we actually look at? And the truth is that what we actually look at are the authors who are coming to visit us because they come number one, and the books that we want to select for our book club, and then we have to just let a lot of it go.
Well, you know, Barbara, I just found out today this book is on the USA Today bestseller list.
Yay! Well, congratulations.
And I didn't even know a fellow, you know, Haley Sutton?
Yeah.
She's the one who, her book is on the list too. She put it on Twitter. And I said, oh, fabulous. And she said, congratulations to you too. I go, what? And then I started looking. So I'm 35. Apparently it was on last week. It was 55.
That's very exciting. And how lucky that they brought that list back, you know, because they dropped it.
For sure.
And they have a new approach, I gather. But the USA Today list is a much broader in scope than the New York Times list. And I'm really glad that they've reconstituted it.
Anything helps, right?
Yeah, it really does. So, you know, since you weren't actually, I'm trying to remember, didn't we do a virtual event for Clark and Division?
Oh, yes.
We did,
You
right?
interviewed me.
Right. Mm-hmm. I knew we talked about it. I was just trying to remember where.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, so since you weren't here to talk about it, why don't we go back and have a little chat about Clark and Division? Because
sure.
I don't think that the reverberations that you write about in Evergreen from what happened in Clark and Division will be that clear unless mm-hmm. this is one of those times where I think you do need to read Clark and Division before you read Evergreen. No, it's not. It's not that. But I think that the whole situation and the emotions and all the things that they're dealing with when they go back to L.A., if you don't read Clark and Division, yeah, it's not a plot spoiler. It's just there's a lot of other stuff. So why did you decide to write after, you know, all this time away? I mean, it's been how many years since 1945?
Oh,
I'm trying to remember. It's been 77 because I was born in 1940, so I can do this math. I'll just subtract five.
Well, you know, that period of time has always been close to me. You know, my Mas Arai series was an homage to my father, who was a gardener, but he was also a Hiroshima survivor, right? And my mother has that same story. So that period of time is of interest to me. I probably would not be born if it weren't for their own personal circumstances. And then I worked at a Japanese-American newspaper called the Rafu Shinpo, which is in Los Angeles. And the seminal thing that we were covering, like in the 80s and the 90s, was redress and reparations for those who had been incarcerated. So that was such a great, I have extended family who were in camp. And when I was at Stanford, you know, I took a civil liberties class and I did a personal, report on what had happened. But I think it wasn't until I worked at the paper and really talked to the people, you know, in a way, even though I was a journalist, I was kind of like an oral historian. And later I kind of I started to do oral histories for nonfiction books. But the interesting thing, because I'm a crime writer too, right? Nonfiction writer, but also as a mystery writer, you know, crime has to be present. I mean, in that case, you could say it was, you know, a larger societal crime, but there also has to be, you know, there has to be some sort of dead body or something like that. And when I was doing some research for a book called Life After Manzanar, which you are selling too, with my girlfriend, Heather Lindquist, I came across a report from the Chicago Resettlers Committee, because Chicago had been the number one destination for people who had been in camp after they were released. So at before World War II, there were like 400 Japanese Americans, and by the mid 1940s, there were like 20,000. So and people ask, well, why? You know, it's the Midwest. It was away from the military zones, and there was a lot of factories, including defense factories. So it's so ironic, you know. You're saying these people are seditious, but you're going to encourage them to work, you know, in defense. Yeah, that really makes sense. But this report mentioned that because the first ones to come were young adults that were in their 20s, they were concerned about juvenile delinquency. You know, they're without their parents, right? So what are you going to do if you were torn away from your home and then you know, you're living behind by briar and then you're sent to like one of the most notorious cities in the U.S., you know? Some people, not all, are going to get in trouble, or they're going to be partying. They're going to be looking for love, you know, all the things that all people would naturally do. And so it mentioned there had been babies being born out of wedlock, and abortions definitely illegal at that time. So these and sundry other things, and I'm going, I never knew about this. And then when I looked at these past oral histories, like people are talking around it, but they're not. And then since that generation's pretty much gone, it's like, okay, this is my job as mystery writer to kind of imagine. I have the bare, you know, you have the crime statistics, but now I'm going to take that and infuse it, you know, in people and just imagine what it was like for them. So Clark and Division is pretty much it's pretty factual. Every kind of criminal activity that's reflected in that book kind of really happened. So, and I was very careful to reflect that. So that was, and then, in terms of the story, it's about two sisters. Aki, the younger sister, that book and this book is told from her perspective. And in Clark and Division, we learn about Rose, the shining star, the older sister, and Aki's always in the shadow of her older sister. And she actually adores her. And then Aki goes first to Chicago. Rose goes first to Chicago, and Aki and her parents follow, only to learn that something terrible has happened to Rose. So it's up to Aki, you know, to step in her sister's shoes, find out what happened, as well as carry her Japanese immigrant parents through that experience. So that's, so you're learning about all this craziness in Chicago with these, and Clark and Division refers to an intersection in Chicago.
Well, it does, but I really pored over the map because the Chicago has always had neighborhoods. When I was a child, it was the largest Polish city in the world. It was bigger than Warsaw, whatever. It was a huge Polish population. The war brought an enormous number of African Americans up for the South, so that great migration thing went on. And but they were mostly to the South at that point. And I was surprised that Clark and Division was really on the near north side, not far from Wrigley Field, as a matter of fact. And the one place that my fellow high school students were allowed to go by ourselves when we were very young, like 10, is that we were allowed to get on the North Shore, the electric train that, ran from Highland Park, I think, downtown. We were allowed to go by ourselves to go to Wrigley Field and watch ball games. So obviously, none of us thought that that was a dangerous neighborhood. But that probably would have been more like 1948 or 49. So most of the Japanese dispersed by then, rather than staying in Chicago, which has a beastly climate, and back then there was no air conditioning, so it's just as horrible in the summer as it was in the winter.
There are people on the south side, and then some went to Lakeview,
Okay.
and they, so I purposely picked this one neighborhood, and it was a kind of notorious neighborhood among the Japanese American community. And I also found this very politically incorrect book about Chicago, written by these guys in the 50s. And it was so interesting because they were they mentioned, they called it Little Tokyo.
Did they?
And nobody really remembers
No,
that.
I certainly don't.
Yeah, but apparently the time they were writing about it, they had come to their own conclusions. So that, and so that's the fun part of doing research, like finding these things on eBay. I think it's called Chicago Confidential or something. There was a whole series of notorious parts of large cities. So,
Well, in Chicago
yeah.
support too, but this was before the St. Lawrence Seaway, so you couldn't just like sail into Lake Michigan from the Atlantic or whatever. And I think that the Chicago River was still reversed at that point. There was a bunch of water engineering and they reversed the flow of the river, and now I think they've reversed it back in an effort to clean up Lake Michigan, which got extremely polluted. Does anybody here from Chicago? Does anyone here remember? Well, not that far back, right? No, I totally get it, right?
There's some sort of close, I'm finding there's a close relationship between Chicago and Los Angeles. There's a lot of
Well, that's where Route 66 went. Route 66 was established to go from Chicago to LA, and it cut across northern Arizona. I drove it home in 1950. I didn't personally drive, but my grandparents who were wintering out here, we all drove home. And you used to go out to, you had to go up and go through Sedona and on up to Williams to catch Route 66, and then you went across to Albuquerque. What's the city before where Ernie Bulow lived? Gallup. Then it went to Gallup, and then it went to Albuquerque, and then you went on and it came up through St. Louis, but it ended in Chicago. So, and then the, yeah. And then the other, that's very true. And then the other big link was the Santa Fe Chieftain. And so after the war, the railroad, before we ruined our railroads, the railroad was still a big thing. And it too went from Chicago, Union Station, to Los Angeles. So, they were. Those two big travel routes started and ended in LA and Chicago, and that is one of the reasons why I think they were relatively close together.
And we have a Highland Park in LA, and then I mean, kind of referring back to Evergreen, one Little Tokyo, became empty, of course, during World War II, and the same migration that you were talking about, Barbara, about blacks from the Deep South going to Chicago, that migration, and that's reflected in Walter Mosley's book and some of Chester Himes. They. Black people from the Deep South went to Los Angeles to work again.
Well,
in the
they went for the defense industry. A lot of them, you know, spent their war years working there. But I'll tell you what is also interesting, so I'm having this nostalgic moment, is I was in Phoenix in 1950 and in the 50s, and the Japanese gardens here were huge. They were gorgeous, but they were a real landmark in Phoenix. And, you know, I was thinking to myself that they couldn't have, somebody kept them going, whether, you know, people were interned from Phoenix during the war or not. Maybe they were only interned from California.
Well, I think, you know, we might have talked about this before, but Phoenix, during World War II, Phoenix was split. So it depended on what side of Phoenix you were on. If you're on, I believe, on the west side, you had to go into camp.
Okay.
And if you're on the east side, you didn't. It was very bizarre.
Was
yeah,
there?
And then the Gila River. Yeah, there was the Gila River. A lot of people. It could have been. I don't remember. Yes.
How interesting. They thought people could get to the Japanese coast farther, I mean,
I
faster
know,
if they were
right?
on the
it's
west side.
It's one of these things that really don't make
no,
a lot of
it,
sense.
I know there was a German camp here, but that was a prisoner of war camp right down here at Papago, you know, Papago Park. There was a big. It's always been one of my favorite books by Betty Webb, where she wrote about, I think I've told you, you know, maybe I didn't tell you, that there was a great escape moment with the, with the German prisoners. And what they did is they built a boat, because their idea was that they would build their boat and launch it into the Great Salt River. And then they would sail down all the way to, you know, the Gulf of whatever it is in California and make their way back to Germany. Of course, it came to grief because there wasn't any water in the Great Salt River. But I've always thought, I don't know if that's a true or whether, you know, that she made that up. But the camp was there for sure.
Yeah.
But I didn't realize there were Japanese camps here. I mean, internment camps here, not prisoner of war, but rather internment.
It was on the Indian reservation in Gila. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're too young to remember this, Patrick. What a shame.
Uh-huh, exactly. Yeah.
How was it?
And there were people from, actually where I'm from, Pasadena. They were sent to Gila River. Also Fresno, they were there as well. So. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, it's like, who are all these people moving onto our land, you know? Yeah.
Really? Oh, yeah. Before Sun City?
Oh,
wow. Well, you know, another question which I've never really looked into, but if they weren't actually interned, there was certainly a lot of talk about interning Germans in Wisconsin and Missouri, where there were very large German settlements. But whether they actually did, I don't think so, but maybe I'm wrong.
There was no mass incarceration.
Right.
You know, it was more targeted. There were like, it was under the Department of Justice. They had... you know, and these individuals, they were all immigrants. They were not American citizens. They were maybe certain leaders that had certain ties. There was a camp in Crystal City, Texas.
Okay.
And I think there's books about that as well. And there was one camp that had German, Italians, and Japanese Peruvians, because...
Yeah, Peru has a very large Japanese population.
Because the Peruvian government and the American government made a deal.
Really?
Yeah, because they wanted these people so they could participate in a prisoner of war exchange with Japan. And it was like kind of crazy because some of these people had never been in Japan, like
right.
the kids. So it was like, yeah, all these crazy things were happening. And
there was a lot of hysteria that takes over during the war.
Yeah.
We can look at what's going on in the Ukraine and recognize that that is the same. Well, happily, the war is ended in Evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
Yay. And so Aki, at least, and her family are returning to Los Angeles. So why don't you, and I love the landlord. Tell us about the landlord that they found, because that's a wonderful story.
Oh, So Aki's family had lived in a part of Los Angeles called Tropical or Atwater. It's near Glendale in Los Angeles, but they couldn't return back to their home. They had to instead go to a place called Boyle Heights, which is right next to downtown LA. It's kind of like the way station for immigrants and disenfranchised people. Before the war, it had the largest concentration of Jewish Americans on the West Coast and maybe even west of the Rockies. And it was a very limited area. But one of the reasons why were Jews were not considered white, so they had at least according to the racial covenants there. And I guess because of World War II, they said, well, we got to kind of change our thinking, you know. And now those kind of racial covenants were lifted regarding Jewish Americans, and they could move to the west side of Los Angeles. So one of when Aki is like looking for housing, I mean, one benefit was art. She's married now. She's a newlywed. I shouldn't. I won't say his full name. And and then so she's, you know, her husband's still in Europe, so she's trying to find housing. So she goes into Boyle Heights, and it turns out a Jewish American man who's going to move out of the neighborhood decides to give her a break. And then when he finds out that her husband is fought for the 142nd, you know, Regimental Combat Team, that was the all Japanese American, they're the most decorated for a unit of their size. Then he just wants to accommodate their needs. And one of the units they had liberated, not necessarily, I don't think it was the Dachau, but there were sub camps. They had opened up those camps, these Japanese American soldiers. And I think some of the survivors were kind of surprised. Why are these Japanese looking, Asian looking people, you know, freeing us, you know? But he had heard that story. So he wanted, and that's not known. That story's not known. But when I worked at the paper, we covered that a lot. And there were some reunions of Jewish prisoners, you know, with the tattoos and like hugging some of these Nisei soldiers. So I just thought that was like a beautiful story. So that's why I wanted to include it in Evergreen.
It is a beautiful story, and one that, you know, I think is surprising because it's amazing how fast history gets lost until you know, go back and look at it. It's certainly true that people, the soldiers were not demobbed. Right, you know, the war ended, not everybody came home all at once. Some of them still stayed overseas for long periods of time. You know, Aki's husband is one of them. You know, your fellow author at Soho, James R. Benn,
Yes.
did write in either the last book or the one before, he wrote about the Nisei regiment in
Yeah.
France and their heroic act.
Yeah, actually, my father-in-law's name, he was a member of that unit, was used. Because, yeah, his name's Toko Fukuchi. So, James has been such a help. That's what I love about Soho. This is our publisher. There's so much camaraderie among the writers. Yeah, and actually, James was the one who corrected me first on my Clark and Division arc. He says, I'm sure, you know, he didn't know me at the time, and he was typing a letter to our mutual editor and saying, I'm sure Naomi has corrected this, but she has someone open, this is 1943, opening a beer can with a tab, you know, not a church key. It's like, yeah, I was going, oh, you know,
Church key.
yeah, right. So, but luckily this was an ARC, and I got many other emails from people who had read the ARC, and I tell this often, and one was had the subject line was big mistake. But I said we corrected it, so no problem. But after, you know, James, I mean, he did not do it in a snarky
No, he's
way.
a really nice man.
So I said, well, this is my friend, and we're kind of dealing with the same time period, so we got to help each other. And then when he was writing his that particular book, he, you know, I sent him information about my father-in-law, my late father-in-law, and he incorporated it in the book, which was really nice.
It is. He does wonderful World War II books that tell you bits of history that you don't know. He will be here on September 6th
Oh,
with
good.
his new Billy Boy book. And, you know, he's writing his way through World War II, Fortunately, if you're writing historical fiction, you don't have to age people because they're already old, right? So he's going like bit to bit as it goes along. He's going to run out of war eventually. But, well, he will, you know, it's
well,
just going to happen.
I've never met him in person,
oh,
so give him my regards.
I will. He's really just a lovely guy. Yeah. And like you, he really loves research.
Yeah.
And, you know, he tries very hard. All of his books but one have taken place in Europe or in England, but he wrote one absolutely astonishing book where Billy is sent to the South Pacific, and it's when JFK was in the PT, whatever boat it was, remember? And he has this really astonishing book, the only one in the other theater. And then Billy goes back to Europe.
Yeah, he helped me. So with my father-in-law, so there's a storyline in Evergreen about veterans, World War II veterans, and shell shock or post-traumatic stress. And that was motivated actually by my late father-in-law. I would always give him, when he was alive, give him material. Their motto was go for broke. Because it was like they fought with such ferocity, you know, just forget about everything, just go for it. And I would give these, you know, historic books and things to my father-in-law. And he said, one day he said, Naomi, don't give me that stuff anymore. It's not nice. And it was like, I was mortified. Like, what had I done? But then it dawned on me, like, while we want to celebrate what they did, you know, their heroism on the side of it, on the other side, he had seen combat. He was on the front line. He had been shot. He had sustained a wound. You know, he had to wear a knee brace for the rest of his life. So it was the other side, you know. So he, and I thought that's kind of interesting to you know, it has been reflected in a lot of literature, but I thought from a Nisei perspective, that would be kind of interesting. So I talked to James, actually. He referred me to a documentary that John Huston had done. And it was on Netflix. I have a pretty lengthy resources, you know, in the back, and you could find it. And it was like never really released at the time because they didn't want to show that veterans had had a hard time after fighting. And that was eye-opening, this black and white film. I talked to friends who worked with Nisei vets, and they said, yeah, Naomi, you know, a lot of them later in life had, like, emotional, psychological issues, and they went to the Veterans Administration. And, you know, so, and then another friend of mine, he works for a website called Densho, and that's, like, for a lot of Japanese-American history, and he's kind of a quirky guy. He goes, Naomi, I have this list of crimes committed by veterans, you know. And I was going, oh my God. I mean, not that that's anything to be happy about, but I think it kind of shows that it did take its toll and did manifest itself in some, you know, like people just were acting out in weird ways. And again, as a crime writer, I go, oh, there's something, there's a knot to all of this that I can explore in a book. And maybe it's too sensitive for someone to write about it, on, you know, from a memoir or a biographical point of view. But I can look into it through a mystery.
Well, and you do, in fact, in Evergreen. So Aki and her family returned to Los Angeles, and thanks to the kind Jewish homeowner, they have a place to live. So where does it go from there? I really like the fact that there's a map in this book to orient you to the neighborhood in LA, just as there was a map in Clark and Division.
And I love maps.
I do too. Yeah. But I think it's really, I mean, true, we can all look it up on our phone, but it's sort of nice to, you know, find it in the book.
Yeah. And I regarding the maps, the locations that I pick, I try to pick at least most of the locations, the building, some kind of building still exists. Mm. So I want people, and then I have some postcards I can give you with that feature that map. So people can actually, if they're in Los Angeles, if they live in town, they can actually, you know, walk the area and kind of imagine. So now Aki, she's a nurse's aide. She works in the Japanese hospital, which is located in Boyle Heights, walking distance. And one patient comes in and an elderly patient, like in his late 50s, because you got to remember this is 1940s and she's in her 20s, right? So that's old, you know. And people didn't live that long back then either. And she's suspicious of like these wounds that these bruises that he has. And then she wants to talk to the son who has brought him in. And then, yeah, she's shocked that that's someone, her husband. You know, this man had been her husband's best man in the wedding. So that starts, you know, her kind of confusion and concern. And, yeah, so the whole circumstance kind of starts to unravel. And when her husband eventually returns to the U.S. and tries to acclimate himself to Los Angeles, more kind of conflict, you know, and even in their marriage kind of comes out because they don't really know each other, you know.
And there's no privacy in the house either, you know. I mean, this is a whole bunch of people living in, you know, a not particularly well-built house with very thin walls. So you do have to think about that as well, how proximate people were. You know, privacy was a more difficult thing to acquire, especially for a young married couple.
So when I do these books that has like this historic backdrop, it can't just be that. It has to be a personal kind of problem. And with Aki Dilemma, it's like trying to find, she's continually trying to find herself and find her voice, but it's also to find herself in this marriage, you know. And this is an era, and this is a community. If you get divorced, it's like a really big deal. There's a lot of, especially for the woman, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of consequences. And so so that's kind of like the two, there's solving the crime, but also will Aki be able to sustain her marriage, you know.
So tell us what evergreen means.
Evergreen actually is, so I love geography. So Clark and Division is an intersection, right, in Chicago, and Evergreen is a major street in Boyle Heights. And off of that is like, there's a famous like Evergreen Cemetery, and then there's a Montrose Cemetery in Chicago that actually was run by a German, and they accepted Japanese American bodies. That was the only cemetery that did so. And in Evergreen, the Evergreen Cemetery, I'm sure it's been on Bosch, you know, I'm sure. Have you seen it on Bosch? But anyway, you know, they have a African-American section. They have a pauper section. It's just like you could just get a whole picture of working class Los Angeles by going to this cemetery.
They have actual neighborhoods in the cemetery. I always find that to be
really interesting. Yeah. And then they have those little portraits, you know, that of the people. That's really fascinating too. So if you're really into history, I'd say, yeah, check out the Evergreen Cemetery.
You can, you know, if you go to Boston, if you go to Winston-Salem and go to the cemetery there, it's absolutely fascinating. I love cemeteries. I've been to cemeteries all over the world.
Yeah, people are choosing not to get buried anymore. So it's just like our letters.
We're running out of land is one of the reasons.
True,
no,
yeah.
It's very true. Yeah. Also, you know, it used to feel, not to be macabre, but people used to think if they were buried, that was like forever. And now with developers and wars and all the rest of it, people are, you know, cemeteries are being dug up all the time. And so it doesn't feel very permanent today as it might have. Are you working on another Japantown mystery, or have you told your story and you're going to write something else?
So Clark and Division and Evergreen are bookends to the Aki story. I don't plan on bringing Aki back, but it's going to be kind of loosely linked. So the next one is called Crown City, which is the old name for Pasadena, where I'm from. And it's going to be take place in 1903. So I'm going back in time.
Way back.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm so excited. I'm such a geek for all this stuff. And this is, you know, the Because I've always wanted to write something about Pasadena, but if you've been there, it's a very pretty place. You know, where's the darkness? I gotta find the darkness, you know. And actually, I still haven't quite found it, but this is going to be more like a joyful book. It's going to celebrate architecture and the arts and crafts.
And the Rose Bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what a lot of us know Pasadena for.
But that didn't come until the 1920s. But here again is the there's conversations between LA and Chicago because it has ties to the 1892 Chicago World's Fair, and that, you know, Jackson Park. I was just there, and that's where they had the Japanese village that introduced this kind of art. So apparently Frank Lloyd Wright went there and was wowed. And then the Green and Green brothers, who are kind of, if you're familiar with those two architects, they kind of pioneered the way for the arts and crafts. They apparently, they never went to Japan, but they went to that fair and they're going, what is this? And they got really fascinated. And I'm just, yeah, I'm kind of looking at this convergence of all these, well, it's a lot about wealthy people. So it's like, I gotta have some relief from this really hard, you know, dual books and kind of just look at art. And I'm still going to be examining it from a critical eye, but I think it'll be a lot of fun. And I'm still trying to develop, you know, I have to have a dead body. So I'm still digging.
You know what? You actually don't. A crime novel can really, it can be a heist novel. It can be a theft. It can be a kidnapping. You know,
it could
doesn't
be a missing
actually,
person.
And a missing person. You know, not all crime fiction has to be a murder mystery. There are all kinds of other crimes that you can explore.
You know, this book may be that type of novel, like you just said, but we'll see what it goes. I am just totally nerding out, and it's really fun. What I think I try to do is try to find things that people don't know about, you know, and I guess that's what I'm attempting to do right now. And it's leading to a lot of research at Huntington Library. I'm going to Stanford next month to do some research as well. So I'm really excited.
Just got my alumni magazine. Are you one of the authors that is listed, because the Stanford Alumni Magazine does features on authors who are in fact alumni of the university. Have you submitted a book to that, or have they talked to you?
Vanessa Hua, Hua, she actually did a story on me. Yeah, a while back.
Grace Lee, who I think is a wonderful writer, her book Portrait of a Thief.
Yeah,
is,
I know.
And she's actually, I'm trying to remember,
she
pre-med, isn't she? Or
no,
medical,
she's medical
actually
school.
In medical school.
I met
school.
Her.
Yeah.
It's like one of these people, they have to be so smart to go to medical school and write a good book. Like, come on. It's too much. And her next book sounds fascinating, too.
Well, hers, and try to remember that it was a heist novel, Portrait of a Thief.
Yeah,
there
true.
Were no dead bodies
true,
in
true,
Portrait
true,
of a Thief.
True. Yeah, maybe we could like look at mysteries with no dead bodies. You know?
Why not?
Yeah, Barbara, you help me out. And if you... Let's do a list so I could study up.
I'll be glad to send you one. There's the Earthy Sayers stories that if you go all the way back to Trollope in the Eustace Diamonds, you know, it was a diamond theft, kidnapping. I don't know if any of you know Sue Grafton's story. You may not be familiar with this, but, you know, she loved to tell stories on herself. She was always so funny. And when she got to Kay, it was K for kidnapping. K is for kidnapping. And so she was like, what'd she say? 120 pages into it or something. And she had, you know, Kinsey also investigating the kidnapping. And all of a sudden she realized that kidnapping's a federal crime and is not possible for kid, can't be investigated. So it became K is for killer. It's just, you know, so you do have to kind of remember that who your sleuths are and what they can investigate, Yeah, Sue was great. She always had funny stories to tell about her writing and, you know, how she got to things. But it is important, I think, if you're not going to write a murder mystery. And even then, you know, sometimes, particularly in some of the lighter forms, the sleuth is so improbable.
Yeah.
So you do have to have somebody that has kind of an actual credential, or at least a compelling reason to be research,
for
you know,
sure.
working on this. And also that the cops or whoever the investigative are going to let them do it.
Right. Yeah.
Which
but,
is.
But Barbara, don't you think a lot of these if you really look at it, they're so much a fantasy, like even.
Sure.
You
they're
know,
fun.
Right. Well, even the darker stuff or police procedure, you know, how many police officers have really discharged a gun? You know, it's like not many have been in these terrible gunfights or things like that we've seen, you know.
Yeah, there's a certain suspension, as we call it, of disbelief.
So we have to make the world believable to our readers somehow.
I agree. Well, and I think that's one of the reasons that Clark and Division and Evergreen are so good, is that they are entirely believable when you read them. They're not, you know, in any way fantastic. How about questions? What would you all like to ask?
This is just a little fact that when I started reading, the two sisters had such a different name.
Yes.
I imagine that was intentional.
You know what it was? I was having such a hard time because names are really important to me. And for some reason, I knew the older sister was Rose. It just like... Yeah, it just fit. It probably my connection to Pasadena or something. But I have, you know, a lot of it's motivated by people I know. And there were just certain roses in my life. And that's what it was going to be. And then with Aki, it was like I played around with Dorothy and Dot. And, you know, I was like, I just couldn't figure. And then it became Aki. And I, you know. It should have been like a more westernized name. And actually, I explain it in Evergreen. I do, because I knew that, but it was just so, such an organic, emotional thing. It's like when her name became Aki, it just kind of, everything kind of made sense. You know, but most Nisei, they're like Aki should have been her middle name. You know, and then she, like Dorothy Aki, you know, and then sometimes growing up, you know, it's like Aki just fits. So even though her first name is Dorothy, you know, people call her Aki. You know, I could have done it that way. But I kind of explain it in Evergreen. I could tell you now, but yeah. But that's a good, a good observation. But yeah, sometimes, you know, it's so intuitive or emotional. And this is the interesting thing. I did not. And then Aki was because I have two dear friends whose names are Akiko and they're called Aki. So I think because I liked them so much. And then it wasn't. It was after this Clark and Division was published. It just dawned on me. My brother-in-law, his name is Wayne, but his middle name's Aki. And I'm sure that was like part of like. Mm-hmm. It too was so weird, you know, but it just, but I knew I had to explain why does she have a Japanese name and her older sister's Rose? Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Have your books been popular in Japan?
So I've had three books translated into Japanese. The one that seemed the best received was my last Masarai, which is called Hiroshima Boy. And that was just published, I guess, a couple years ago. And it was up for two awards, actually, in Japan. Like the Hiroshima, the city, I guess, has their own. It didn't win. But still, it's an honor to be nominated. And so it was up for a Hiroshima Book Award. And then my translator was so wonderful. You know, just like in America, you know, you have the Brooklyn accent, you got the Texas. She imbued my book with a Hiroshima, like a dialect, and people loved it. So it was up for a Hiroshima award. Yeah, and there was even talk, you know, some Japanese producer, you know, there's always talk, wanted to adapt it for a movie, but it never got off the ground. But yeah, so, and this is, Clark and Division is supposed to be translate into Japanese, but it's not out yet. But this is the interesting thing about translations. For the French translation, it was the name, I can't say it in French, was, but it's like My Sister Died in Chicago was the what's the title. Yeah, because they don't know what Clark and Division is.
Yeah.
You know, Yeah, and they had to get Chicago in there somehow. Yeah. It was kind of spoiler alert. Yeah.
Actually, this is Women in Translation Month. There's a number of books being highlighted, books written by women and translated by women. Most of the ones I've looked at have been translated from another language into English, but it would work in reverse. The French are actually huge consumers of crime fiction. They absolutely, roman noir, they call them. They even have an award. And they actually like dark things, but they also like historical things.
Yeah, I think I'm not quite dark enough for the French. They've translated, actually, three of the Moss. I think Moss was a hard one. And I think because in those books I have, I'm speaking in dialect, I think their translator, you know, is a challenge.
Yeah, but there's always been there for many years, certainly in the 19th century, there's been a real affinity for French and Japanese culture. When Japan opened up in 1856 or something, the Japanese fell hard for the French and vice versa. Yeah. Painting, you know, clothing, all kinds of things. And in fact, when I was in Okayama the last time, there's an absolutely fabulous restaurant entirely in French with a Japanese chef and Japanese whatever, but the menu's in French and the food is in French and the whole bit, which I really enjoyed. But the chef said to me later that I was the only person who'd eaten there in years that actually could read the French. He was trained in Paris.
There's a Franco-Japanese kind of... that was really popular, I think, in Los Angeles, I guess maybe in the 1990s. There's a place in Little Tokyo, if you ever go, called Azay, and it has a wonderful Japanese breakfast. So but it's only open at 11. It's not open any earlier than 11, so it's a late breakfast. So I recommend
it. If you tour Japan, in order to help you out, so they don't have to translate the menu, outside... Not the really classy restaurants, but most of the restaurants where tourists might happen to go, they have photographs of the food. And, you know, so when you go in, you can point to whichever ramen bowl or whatever it is that, you know, looks the most interesting to you, and you can order it. But we once, when Lori, who lied to me about learning kanji, so we got lost in Japan, because none of us could read the language, or the GPS was also in kanji, so it made it additionally difficult. But we ended up in a Japanese truck stop outside one of the major shrines, and the guides for the shrines took pity on us, and they ordered for us, which is great. Actually, it was the best meal we had in Japan. I loved it. We were sitting at the counter with the Japanese truck drivers, and, you know, they were ordering food for us, and it was so great. The Japanese are very hospitable if you're a tourist.
I think there's something to getting lost, like no matter where it is. I think it's important, you know. You learn a lot, yeah, from that, yeah.
Fabulous. Patrick, do we still have that little book in the back that Lori and I wrote? Don't we still have some copies of it? Why didn't you look? Because we could just hand them out tonight. I'll go look while Naomi is me. I'd be happy to give you each a copy. Lori and I wrote it together when we got back. Yeah, no, well, I think...
Will you sign it first?
Oh, yeah, right. I think Lori signed them. No, actually, our very best adventure, the one I've always been the happiest with, is that while we were lost in Shikoku, we were looking for the male and female bridge that, you know, bridge that, because one of the ways that the older Japanese, the more indigenous Japanese could escape the shogun and the attempts to civilize it was they retreated to Shikoku, and they had bridges made of vines that they could pull up, so they were safe on the other side of the ridges in the mountains. But anyway, by getting lost, we arrived at the male and female bridge by accident, and it's just completely out. There was nobody there except some nice little old lady selling tickets in the little booth. And we all wandered down there. We've been in the car for hours. I mean, hours. And we wandered down, and there are the bridges. And Lori didn't want to cross, but Rob and I decided. He went over the male bridge, and I went over the female bridge. And we reached the other side. There was a little wooden shack, and it looked very much like an outhouse, right? I was pretty desperate. So I went across to the outhouse. I've never forgotten this. And I opened the door. And when I did, the Toto toilet lid rose to greet me. It was electronic. So I we have it. I came home and the first thing I did was remodel my bathroom and put in a Toto toilet.
Yeah, so you're great. Lucky.
I know. I mean, seriously, it is. But I mean, it's just they had apparently managed to like one wire, you know,
that's
to
amazing.
Raise the Toto toilet. Yeah.
That's so funny.
We did that just for fun. Yeah. But,
you know, this is too much information, but from Amazon, we have like the cheap bidet version. You know, it's not heated. And it, but it's still good.
Mine is heated. I love my Toto toilet. And I will tell you also, there is only one plumber in the entire state of Arizona who is licensed to work on Toto toilets.
That's
yep,
crazy.
I had to find him at one point, and it takes a lot of work to get in touch with him because he's so in demand. It's like he's like a shadow plumber. You have to locate him, and the whole bit.
This is a crazy place.
Isn't it great? There's a Toto Museum in, I'm trying to remember, was it in Tokyo or somewhere in Japan anyway, because it's a huge company, you know.
And
there's an actual museum of all of it. Isn't that fun? You'll love it.
I'm getting a whole different impression of you.
Well.
Aren't you glad you all came here to get
right.
this room?
I thought of it actually this afternoon when I wrote to invite everybody
Should
to come.
Should I say something inappropriate again?
Sure.
When we were visiting my uncle in Japan, my husband and I in the and he lived close to Kobe. Well, in a beautiful apartment, they call them mansions. But he took my husband to the bathroom to the Toto. And then you'll see, like, you know, little buttons. And he's going, bigu, smaru. Bigu, smaru.
Some of them have a musical button. So if you're in a public restroom in Japan, most people use the musical buttons so that your neighbor on either side will not be listening. I know. It's just fabulous.
This is very inappropriate. Sorry.
It's all right. We had a lot of fun on the trip. And actually, Lori wrote a Mary Russell book out of that trip, which is dedicated to Rob and me for taking her on the trip. So, wow.
So okay.
Anybody else? We probably stymied you now. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm going to take us away from the toilet.
Yeah. Please do. Please. We need to.
So one thing is a thought, but you said that your future book that you're working on is But I wanted to ask about your cover. Your covers for Carbon Division and Evergreen are so powerful and amazing. I'm wondering how much input you get to have on them.
I had a lot of input, and that
was so beautiful.
We had to go through a lot of different versions, and Soho's been great. They've, you know, and I've published a lot of books. So, you know, I have some idea. I think I'm able to kind of stand back a little and kind of see what's going to, because I want a cover that's going to sell, you know, too. And with Clark and Division, they show me three versions. We went with one and then just played around with the font and everything. Evergreen was a little more painful, to tell you quite honestly. I think one of the thinking of Soho is they kind of saw that it was my readership is kind of a crossover. There's mystery readers, but there's also people who like historical fiction. And that the historical fiction people, it's a really big market. Mm-hmm. So I think they were trying to do more like a book, you know, that kind of. And the initial ones were the mystery was all gone, was not there at all. And I was going, I don't think this works. And it's also hard when you're dealing with an Asian, you know, one question or one issue is how much of a person's face do you show? And it, you know, I don't want to, you know, cut off this woman's face. But like in Clark and Division, we had a version with the whole face. But I was going, that does not look like Aki, and that does not look
like a movie.
Yeah, it just did not look like, I mean, I appreciated they had the whole face, but it wasn't my character. So, you know, I want the readers to imagine to some degree. So that's, you know, and then we kind of repeated it with Evergreen. But it's hard to find, you know, stock photos or whatever, you know, and they were considering actually doing some original photography too. But that's hard too, because this is set in the 1940s, you know, and people, you know, even if they're dressed differently, something about their face doesn't seem quite the same as in the 1940s either. So it was very difficult, but we went around. Yeah.
Mouth, if you look at movies and other stuff, if you look at people's mouths, they're very different in the 30s and 40s movies than mouth makeup.
And this is, actually, I suggested this silhouette of a man, because it's not only a female story, but it's also, it's a lot about, you know, men and dealing with combat and finding, you know, so there had to be some, you know, some representation of that. Yeah, so it's really, it's tough. It's really tough. And there's things that, as a native Californian that knows, you know, Boyle Heights, I would want different kind of images. But those images would not translate to people outside of the area, you know. So it's really, and then my agent's from Tennessee, you know, and she was, I think she was like, palm trees, that's Los Angeles, yeah. You know. And it's like, oh, that's so stereotypical. But it is, you know, it's like, okay, I can do, I was walking outside my house, I go, oh, there's a palm tree, there's a palm tree, there's a palm tree, you know. So it's like a stereotype, but it's true. So, you know.
I think it's the palette. I love the color combination. I think it's really beautiful.
And that was Soho, because it was a bluish one. And then they, and it's also Evergreen. You think, oh, should you make it green, right? Go to the literal, you know. Yeah. So, and I'm glad they made this. And then look, I got to undress this. Yeah. Da 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 da. Da da da. But isn't that pretty? Maybe. That's really pretty.
Show the inside too, because right inside the cover. See, this is where the map is.
Yeah.
That's where the map is, which I think is really great.
I mean, I'm just so happy with this publisher, because I do think like a hardcover book is expensive. So I want it to be a beautiful object, you know?
Right. And your editor actually speaks Japanese and translates Japanese too, which is really, because she's brought in one or two Japanese authors that she's translated herself. So she's an amazing person. If you're watching, Juliet, you're amazing. No, probably not, but still, a salute to Juliet. Well, does anybody else have a final question? Patrick.
Oh, that's a good question.
I mean, during the war, the First World War was the Great War.
Yeah.
All this happened. What about during World War? What about during the Second World War?
That's a really good. That's a really good. Yeah.
Try your phone. I honestly, I really don't know.
I don't know either. That's a really good question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was in two theaters too, as opposed to the first World War One was basically Europe, but you know, there was an Asian theater and then the rest of the theater in the Second World War. So, you know, now they're worried about a Third World War, but probably they're going to call it the Third World War if it actually happens.
Well, both Clark and Division and Evergreen is written by Aki, you know, a little bit later. So there's that too. Yeah. There were a lot of great baseball players. Yeah. So amalgamation, you know, there, and Babe Ruth did, you know, play with Japanese players in exhibition games. Yeah. So I had to put that in there. I love sports.
You have some excellent Japanese golfers going on right now, actually. Yeah. Right. Well, thank you all very much for coming this evening. Let's give Naomi a round of applause. It was really fun.
Yeah. I never thought we'd talk about toilets.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.